This message comes from Capital One Commercial Bank. Your business requires commercial banking solutions that prioritize your long-term success. With Capital One, get a full suite of financial products and services tailored to meet your needs today and goals for tomorrow. Learn more at CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Seven of them said they would not trust FSD to drive them. And one said he would not ride in a Tesla Robotaxi, quote, if you paid me. So there are problems. Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show from Inside EVs all about the future of transportation. I'm Tim Levin.
And I'm Matt Hogan.
On this week's show, we are starting off with a little bit more on the Ferrari Luce. I know this has been beaten to death on social media and everywhere, but I was there and I haven't had the chance to talk about it yet. Plus, we talk big improvements to America's EV charging network, and we check in with Tesla's robotaxi ambitions. Tesla's $1.6 trillion market cap is riding on the company finally scaling self-driving, but it's been slow going. And a new report from Reuters casts doubt on how quickly that'll happen at all.
Let's get into it. Tim, we'll start with you. Finally, someone has an opinion on the Ferrari Luce.
Yeah. And why is nobody talking about this?
Yeah. Have you guys heard about that? They're doing Ferrari, but it's got like batteries or something. I don't know. Tim was there. Tim, you can tell me about it.
Yeah, I don't want to go like too deep into it, but were you surprised at the level? Like, I sent you the picture of it like a little bit before. Or let me back up for a second. I was in Rome. I saw the debut of this. I covered it for us. I did a video on it, which you can check out on the YouTube channel. And there were kind of like murmurs throughout the weekend. People were like, yeah, it's an odd one. And like, it's probably going to be rough for them, for Ferrari, when this thing comes out. I didn't expect the level of fierce backlash that happened. Did you, when I sent it to you? Maybe you probably didn't think about it that much, but
I mean, you've been on the internet before, right? I mean, yeah, people were mad.
But it was like New York Times, like everywhere was talking about it.
I think the intensity of the reaction did not surprise me at all. I was surprised when you sent me the picture of it, because I was expecting it to look, I mean, I think we'd seen some spy shots of it looking kind of like a Puro Sangue, like the weird, they don't want to call it an SUV, but it is. And I thought we were going to get kind of an electric take on that, which is just like the existing design, but uglier, probably because the proportions would be weird. I mean, as you've seen with Polestar 4 and all these other like electric quasi sedans, like electric batteries, especially in cars that maybe aren't like at the forefront of battery technology, the batteries are thick. They go in the floor. That makes these kind of tall and weird. And I mean, if you look at the side of my Blazer EV, it's like half cladding to hide how, you know, thick the floor of it is, right? So I always expected there to be a really negative backlash, both because I knew the design was going to have to be somewhat different to what they did, or to what they've done in the past. And I knew that car enthusiasts are a persnickety bunch who are going to be mad about any like performance brand going electric. I mean, it seems hard to remember, but there was like negative backlash when they announced they were going to do a Porsche EV, when now the Taycan, like everyone loves it. So I expected there to be a harsh backlash among enthusiasts and Ferrari fans. I did not expect it to break through to the level that it did. Like you were saying, New York Times, like, I mean, I got interviewed by NPR this morning for it. I mean, there was tons and tons of news coverage all over the place, big stories, and, you know, Washington Post had something. They were just, everyone was talking about the backlash, and so much more conversation about the conversation than conversation about the car, right? So it didn't, I always knew they were going to be a big backlash, but I also didn't expect them to take as much of a risk with the styling as they did. And when you sent me that picture, my thought was, oh, at least it's going to be interesting. Like, it's not going to be the same thing. That, you know, just the same language just applied to an EV.
Yeah, I agree with that. I commend them for doing something interesting and fun and different. And maybe that's because I'm not like a big performance car or Ferrari fan. Like, I don't really care how their cars look. And I like the like product design, like industrial design aesthetic that they brought to that. Like, it really does have a Tesla, Rivian, Polestar quality, and people were like dumping on it, and they were like, it looked like a Polestar. I'm like, Polestars look cool, and this is like a much higher end, much more designed version of that.
I also think just the hand wringing over, like, this happens. It's why I knew this was going to be a conversation. It's why there's a big conversation when Apple launches a new project, or if something, or when, you know, all of these brands, when they first introduced EVs and, or sorry, SUVs, and Porsche said, okay, here's the Cayenne, and everyone said it's going to kill the brand, and then it, you know, is actually the most transformational product they've ever had. And I think there's a lot of hand-wringing in the enthusiast, hyper, like, filter bubble, deep car nerd thing of, like, this is not, like, what the soul of Ferrari means. And I think just the average person, even the average Ferrari buyer, like, that's just not how they approach these things. It's, like, literally comes down to, like, does this look cool? And, you know, I think it does look cool. I understand if people don't. I also do think, I get that you might want a little more flair for $650,000, like, whatever. But, yeah, this concept of, like, oh, this is not what a Ferrari means. I got sent some reel of some, like, F1 commentator being, like, oh, this is where why the brand just doesn't have the, like, meaning. It's like, guys, these are brands. They're not your friends. They're not, like, historic institutions that stand for anything. They stand for making money, and they would like to continue making money for the future. So they need to find a way to design EVs specifically to the EV, you know, benefits and drawbacks, right? And that was why I was a little happy they leaned into the proportions, because, like, if you try to just make a conventional-looking supercar with an electric powertrain, it's always going to be a little fatter, a little weirder, a little more awkward, at least until we get thinner batteries, solid state, what have you. And so, also, you don't need a grill. You don't need as much cooling. There's just a lot of different design considerations. And I think the EVs that I find that are least successful on design, like, I love the way a BMW i4 drives, but I don't want one because it looks like it was designed first as a gas car, and then they were like, oh, let's stick a bunch of batteries in here. And the new generation, like i3 and iX3, don't look like that anymore. They look like they were designed to be EVs. And I think
that's a good comparison.
It's something that a lot of car companies have struggled with. They have this historic design language, and they've tried to make it different. Some of them have tried to keep the design language as similar as possible, like the BMWs that I was talking about. But the BMW that was most successful to me of the previous generation was the iX, because it leaned into the weirdness of the EV shape. Mercedes tried to lean into weirdness with the EQ cars, totally whiffed. Now they're going back in the other direction, and it's kind of working. But I like that Ferrari is saying, this is something different to what we build, and it's not a replacement for that.
Yeah.
But that nuance, I mean, we don't do nuance in, like, people want to be mad, and people being mad is what keeps the conversation going. It's what gets the New York Times and NPR to pay more attention to it. And so it's like, it's frustrating because this was in my head always how it was going to go, whether they went conventional or not. But the fact they went less conventional gets a lot more people just like, wait, what? That's a Ferrari? And then they're kind of primed for that hyper angry reaction.
The weirdest thing to me that I saw in the commentary was, this looks like it should be a Honda, or this looks like it should be a Nissan. Or you were even saying that about the interior. They're like, this interior would be great in a economy or like a mainstream car. And I'm like, having been there and been with it, it does not look like it's a mainstream car. Like, it has the crazy wing in the front with all this open space. It's essentially like, you know, it's like this two-tone, right? The black part of it is this like crazy teardrop shape where the nose bends down like way down to the street with this, you know, the colorful bodywork around it. Like, it looks exotic when you're up close to it. And the interior, with all these machined aluminum like dials and switches and all this stuff, works like amazingly.
It looks so,
you know,
cool.
Well,
yeah,
it looks so cool. It's all very like clicky, and it feels expensive. Like, it feels really unique and expensive. And you don't, like, it just doesn't feel like a Honda. Like, the dash, on the dash, there's like this big silvery strip that's basically takes up the whole front of the dash. It's like milled out of a single piece of aluminum. And like, the seat rails are milled out from a single piece of aluminum. Like, it doesn't feel cheap or like basic at all. I don't know really what people are talking about.
Also, on the exterior design, like, yeah, I saw the Honda comment because someone was like, oh, the Honda Saloon, Honda Zero Series Saloon looked like a better version of this or whatever. Or people, even the Nissan account, comparing it to a Nissan Leaf, which I think 90% of that is the similar color shade of teal.
yeah.
But yeah, there is like, it's also just the design trend now to have the black sort of floating roof. But there was, I was talking to Daniel Golson from Jalopnik the other day, and he was talking about this conversation he had had about this with a different journalist, saying, oh, it looks like X, it looks like Y. And he has started just saying, he went to design school, he's a big design guy. And he's like, I just don't play the looks like game anymore, because having been in the car discourse for so long, it really is exhausting to be like, this just looks exactly like that. Like, okay, every car has headlights and taillights in effectively the same place. You can either make them two separate ones or you can connect them with a line. There's a certain shape that's the most aerodynamic. You can make all of it one color, or you can make it two-tone with a black floating roof, and like everything else kind of doesn't work that well. And so like everything is a remix. Everything is a retread of things that have existed before, combined in new ways. And when people's criticism of a car is, oh, it looks like X mixed with Y, it's like every car is going to look like that, because there's just not that much you can do without adding a level of design elements that I think are really tacky and gaudy. Like the Mercedes AMG GT four-door, much better proportions, I think, than the Ferrari, just like nice and low slung, but so many extraneous details of giant Mercedes logos everywhere and detailing that's all Mercedes logos. And I think that's such a challenge that you see played out in the car world in general, is like, I think the best designs ever are ones that are simple and stylish. Old Ferrari 250 GTO, where you're just emphasizing these like very clear lines and it all flows together cohesively and there's not a ton of ornament. And when you start adding ornaments, like I always say, like the GM design team, like they get a raise every time they add a new crease to a car. Like you look at like a C8 Corvette, proportionally it's as cool as a Ferrari, but I find the way all of the creases intersect, there's just too much going on for me to find that to be a beautiful car. And so that's what I mean, where it's like, yeah, if you want to make an aerodynamic shape that still has all of the legally required components, like, yeah, it's going to look like other things. The idea is deriving some sense of personality from there. And I think they did a good job of matching the nose to sort of the supercar style nose of current Ferraris, while also taking it in a different direction. And I'm interested to see, like, yeah, what happens to this car in the really long term? Like 10 years from now, is this going to be the least valuable Ferrari because it's the EV, but it's also the EV from before they figured out how to do all the EV stuff right? Or is this going to feel like, okay, this is when a new era of Ferrari design started?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. It will be fascinating. I don't know how much Ferrari doesn't give a lot of visibility into sales, but I can't imagine they're going to have that hard a time selling, you know, 1,000 of these a year or something. Yeah. Like it's such a low volume. People forget. It's like they sell 10, 12, 13,000 cars a year.
Yeah.
And this is just one in the lineup. Like I don't know that it's going to be, even if it's like this polarizing, don't you think there are 1,000 very rich people in the world who
might want it because it's polarizing?
Yeah.
And there's been some reporting that, yeah, they want to make more inroads into China with this. But there's also, Ferrari is different from the other hyper-performance brands that have made SUVs, because when I was there for the Ferrari Electrica, like, deep dive back before it was called the Luce, and we were just talking about the tech behind it, I was interviewing one of their executives, and I was like, obviously, you know, the Pro saying is that it's the best-selling Ferrari, and she was like, no, it isn't. And one of the PR people was like, no, it isn't. That's not our strategy. Lamborghini, mostly what they sell is the Urus. Bentley is selling primarily Bentaygas, I believe. Like, the SUVs are generally the best-selling vehicles in their lineup because they have the widest use case.
Yeah.
Ferrari intentionally is not. They do not want to become a company that builds primarily SUVs and then also builds supercars and sports cars on the side. And so they've very much limited the Pro Sangue. I think it will be similar here, where they're going to sell all of them because they're not going to try to make that many of them. And they're also, it's really hard to keep up with what all the names of the current Ferraris are, because they just constantly iterate on the cars. There will be you know, in 3 years, there will be a Luce that's a little bit different with a slightly different battery, and they'll change the name entirely and do a bunch of differences on the design. And so I think it's going to be something that is a starting point for them. They're going to sell it to people who want to have the first electric Ferrari ever. A lot of people might be making a play that that will eventually become valuable. And then they're just going to keep iterating on it. And I think it's still going to be a long time before we have a two-door electric replacement for something like a 296 GTB or whatever. But
people are going to freak out. If they freaked out about this, yeah. The last thing I'll say that I forgot is the craziest part of this trip. This was like the most extravagant like launch I've ever been to. Mm-hmm. They were busing like, you know, whatever, a couple hundred people from the hotel to the venue. And they had the Rome police shut down the highway and give us like a police escort.
Hell yeah.
For the 30 minutes to get there. And it was absolutely wild. Just like Italian motorcycle cops ripping next to us in the vans, like screaming, telling people to move out of the way. It's like, these people have to go see a car. Don't you understand?
They just own that province. It's hilarious.
Yeah. That was wild. People were looking in the car. They were like, is that, like, who is it? Is it the Pope? It's like, no, it's just me.
It's Tim Levin.
This message comes from Capital One Commercial Bank. Your business requires commercial banking solutions that prioritize your long-term success. With Capital One, get a full suite of financial products and services tailored to meet your needs today and goals for tomorrow. Learn more at CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
But let's move on to our second segment, because I want to talk about some less controversial and more positive news about just what we've seen the past couple of weeks. We've had a lot of good news on the charging front. And like a lot of the charging stuff, it's like kind of quiet improvements, but it's something that's really resonated with our audience and started last week, as we discussed on the podcast at Plus Minus, that Walmart is rapidly expanding its charging network, vowing to install credit card terminals, which, like, take that as a win. That shouldn't have been ever up in the air, but whatever.
They didn't have them.
Yeah. And then this week we got more news. So Electrify America is ditching its confounding in-app payment system, where you used to have to preload your account with a certain amount of money and then it would deduct from it. But then if it got below a certain threshold, you would automatically add more. So it just meant you always were kind of carrying a hanging balance that just didn't really help you. They're getting rid of that completely. Believe it or not, you're going to be able to just pay exactly how much the charging session costs. We finally have that technology, I suppose. I think that's a big update, just to get rid of any app confusion that we can. And then finally, Rivian also announced that it now has a full 1,000 DC fast charging ports installed across 148 of its Rivian Rivian Adventure Network charging stations, which is a lot bigger number than I think either of us expected. They've been kind of quietly ramping that stuff up in the background. A couple big, you know, pieces of news that are just things getting a little better on the charging front. Tim, what's your takeaway from all this?
Yeah, I was definitely surprised by the Rivian number, 1,000 plugs across almost 150 stations. It feels like a really smart move. Like, you know, the reason so many people want to buy a Tesla is because, you know, automatically, just from like living in the world, you see superchargers everywhere and you know that you'll be good.
Yeah.
And increasingly, that's the case with chargers in general. Like, there just are charging stations everywhere, but there still is this big perception issue where people don't realize that. People don't know that there are chargers. And so the idea that Rivian can like drum up awareness both of its brand and of charging makes a lot of sense to me. You know, you see that you got one near your house and you're like, oh, Rivian has these? Like, maybe I should buy one. I must be like, I'll be good if I want to go charge. So
yeah,
I think, yeah, I think it's a good strategy.
Having positive experiences too, because this was at the, I want to say the launch of the Rivian R1T quad or R1 quad, the second generation ones. I got to interview as part of a roundtable, Rivian CEO, RJ Scaringe, and he was talking about how there's two networks in the country that have over 99% uptime, Tesla and Rivian. Now, it's like saying like there's only two grocers that can do this, Walmart and the corner store, right? Like it's totally a different scale. But he was saying, you know, everything else is pretty far behind. And so there is a real opportunity there of being not just a charging network that's available, but one that you feel like, oh, if it says Rivian on it, I know it's going to work, which I think is a really valuable, you know, play. And also, they're moving to make sure they have NACS, and not all of them are like this yet, but they're very quickly pushing towards everything having NACS and CCS off the rip, which I think is really smart. So yeah, I don't think in the 5-10 year timeline, do I think Rivian Adventure Network is going to be the most meaningful charging network or like really up there with a Tesla or an IONNA? No. But I think they've already done a good job of serving areas that are specifically good to their customers, where like if I want to go to Joshua Tree National Park and charge my car, which I do, right outside it there's a Rivian charging post, and there's one near Yosemite, and there's like places that they know where the customers are going to want to go, they can help fill those gaps, especially because those tend to be more rural places, you know, outside of where maybe the most interstate traffic is going to be.
Yeah, and they also have a ton of, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I was surprised by the number of like destination chargers they have too. It's not just the fast chargers.
Yeah. But I mean, outside of the Rivian news, just in general, I think I'm feeling so much better about both the present and future of charging in this country, of just things like, all the Walmart stations having credit card terminals. Every Electrify America station has credit card terminals. And like, that's not yet true for EVgo. That's not yet true for everyone. But even the new Tesla stations that I've been going to have them, at least the ones here, because in California, they're legally required to have a credit card reader. And I just think, yes, it's great if you have discounts and in your app or whatever, you have subscription programs, but every charger having a credit card terminal, and more cars and charging networks supporting plug and charge. Like, I really think we're already really at the tail end of that era. We're traveling cross country in an EV. You needed to have a bunch of apps and make sure you had a cell connection. So I'm really excited about that. And I'll also just say that like between this and then like companies like IONNA and BP Pulse, and to a smaller degree, like in Southern California, we have one called Rove that are building these like charging hubs or like buckies where you get all of the amenities of a gas station of like amenities of a gas station. It's like a, sounds like an indie
album. I love going to the gas station.
I just go there to get my nails done. But just having bathrooms, having like basic, I think this is helping remind me when we talked about the immaturity of the charging networks in this country, so many people focus on the tech side of that, of like, oh, we need 400 kilowatt chargers and better charging or reliability, and of course we do, but reliability has gotten, at least in my experience, way better. I don't really worry about it that much, but more it's just right sizing how big the charging stations are relative to what they're next to, putting them in more desirable locations, having bathrooms, having attendants, things like this, where it's not about the technology. It's about like, okay, we have this technology. We want to make money off of it and we want to provide service to the customers, but we don't actually know how to connect all these dots. So screw it. We'll put four chargers in the back corner of a, you know, Ralph's and hope for the best. And I think things like Walmart are showing me that like, okay, they did a trial. They, a lot of Electrify America stations I've been to were at Walmart's. And they're like, wow, this is bringing business in. And then these customers are probably, they have plenty of data showing that they have a decent amount of loiter time and that they're much wealthier than the average Walmart customer, just because new car owners in general are much wealthier than the average person in general. And I've always said, like, you have wealthy people standing around for 30 minutes. If you can't figure out how to make money off of that, that's your problem. Like, there's just no reason that this should ever get in the way. And I think companies are finally starting to match the technology with the business model, and that's going to really unlock the next phase of growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, should we move on to Tesla? Tesla isn't close to safely delivering self-driving vehicles at scale. That is a quote. That's the takeaway from a big Reuters investigation that dropped last week into Tesla's robotaxi ambitions.
Yeah, this one was a pretty wild story. I mean, wild in that it was chronicling, it was showing a lot of things we were worried about, but I think at a level of detail and, reporting integrity that we have not seen just how deep this goes.
Yeah, so let me spell out some of the key details here, and we can kind of unpack this as we go along. The basics: Reuters spoke with a bunch of safety experts, plus former Tesla employees involved in data labeling. Those are the people who watch clips of FSD operating in the real world, identify good and bad driving behavior, and try to improve the system. And through this investigation, basically Reuters came to the conclusion that despite the annual promise from Elon Musk of like widespread self-driving next year, that self-driving Teslas are probably far away. And part of that is that these data labelers talked about a bunch of mistakes that they just consistently see FSD making. And some of the things are kind of harrowing. Reuters says that these former employees regularly saw FSD fail at basic tasks. Sometimes they saw FSD piloted vehicles fail to brake on freeway off-ramps, fail to avoid construction zones, nearly striking construction workers, videos of Teslas failing to recognize animals and striking them at speed. And this was a telling and funny quote from these data labelers. So 7 of them said they would not trust FSD to drive them. And one said he would not ride in a Tesla robotaxi, quote, if you fucking paid me. So there are problems that FSD just like there are situations that it's just like not good at yet.
And we should note, these Reuters did not see the videos. They were described these videos by verified former employees, but obviously we have not independently, confirmed these things, though Reuters is about as good as it gets in terms of sources. It's a pretty scary rundown of things that I think, if you've watched a lot of FSD videos, if you've been paying attention, like, it's interesting to see these documented so conclusively. Like, nothing in it is that surprising. I mean, we've seen all of these videos and situations of crashes and reported crashes and lawsuits that take years to play out. But I mean, there's been millions and millions. I think, there was one extremely large verdict over a death that was related to autopilot in the past. And there's just been a lot of problems with this, and they just keep pushing it. And they keep, like you said, I mean, it just keeps saying next year. And it's such a challenge for us on the journalism side when someone so repeatedly lies about a timeline. And obviously you can't disprove a lie that takes place in the future, right? Me, you and I don't have Tesla's roadmap. I can't tell you factually that this will not happen last year. But what we can tell you is that all of the evidence suggests that this is pretty far from being a fully level 4 autonomous system. And the person telling us that it'll be around next year is the same guy who said over half of all US cities at the end of 2025 will have autonomous Tesla robotaxis in them. And he said that in 2025, and that obviously was not anywhere near coming true. I think we finally got numbers on this, right? That there's 42 self-driving Tesla robotaxis in Austin.
State of Texas. Yeah.
And why don't you also break down for me too, one of the more interesting parts that I found was the mapping. What we learned about that.
Yeah. One of Musk's sort of core, philosophies is that Tesla's developing a generalized AI solution, like a car that you can just plop anywhere in the world or anywhere in the United States, and it'll just like understand how to drive places just from the cameras and from the AI system. And like, to their credit, FSD is like pretty impressive. We've talked about it before. We won't like beat it to death, but FSD is pretty impressive. It's not autonomous, but it does navigate traffic and stuff in a pretty capable way. But he said that like this is the big difference between Tesla and Waymo, is that Waymo requires like all this groundwork and all this mapping and all this crap to set up in a city, That makes it like too local and too hard to scale. And he's trying to make something that just scales very easily. Reuters found out that Tesla employees spent hundreds of hours annotating the area where the Cybercab demo took place a couple of years ago in LA. They were driving cars through it constantly to prevent, you know, something embarrassing from happening. This doesn't surprise me terribly. It is obviously like it's interesting because of what Musk has promised before, the fact that like, oh, this is just going to be this amazing generalized solution. Obviously, I think everybody suspected that it was a tightly controlled demo. They also mentioned sort of a similar deal before the launch of robotaxis in Austin, saying that they like did extensive testing. This is a quote from Reuters. Tesla extensively filmed features in a limited robotaxi zone to map the area, capturing stoplights, road signs, and other features. So they're doing a little bit more of this like ground level work than I think they let on.
Yeah, and I think, again, this is where everyone's got to make their own personal choice about how they feel about these systems. Some people would not get in if you fucking paid them. Some people will pay for it. And
yeah,
you know, I was talking to Kyle Connor recently about his Tesla with FSD and how obsessed he is with it because he drives thousands of miles and barely ever touches the wheel. And I was just like, I had a similar experience in that, not thousands of miles, but I had a Model Y and I went about 150 miles. And there was only a couple safety-related interventions I had to make. But one of them was, like, the car had fully stopped at a red light, and then a different light across the street turned green, and the car just started driving through the red light. And then, you know, and that was something where, like, to me, that was an explicit case where having a map of where the lights are, where they're pointed, which ones relate to what, like, that is where that would really come in handy. And this is, you know, an area in San Diego. It's not the first time a Tesla has gone down that road. I can guarantee you that. But when you're not annotating everything and you don't have a dedicated mapping team the way that Waymo does for these new areas, like Waymo isn't active in San Diego, but I see Waymo taxis in my neighborhood all the time because they're just mapping everything, encountering all of the obstacles before anyone has to put their life in their hands. And I think this is another one of those challenges because if they're lying, maybe it's not the right word. I don't want to accuse anyone of anything. But if you can't trust their word on how they develop it, when it will be deployed, how it will be deployed, and then also, which we can get into, all of the safety data that I think they have revealed so little data about how safe FSD is. And when they do, it's always these comparisons that the Reuters investigation shows don't really hold up to scrutiny. So they always talk about, oh, it's, they used to always say 10 times FSD or Teslas with autopilot plus FSD crash 10 times less often. But here's an excerpt from there. Tesla, for instance, exaggerates the technology safeties by comparing a rate of crashes in FSD piloted Teslas that triggered airbag deployments to a federal crash rate for all vehicles that includes far less severe accidents. And that the company also compares its cars to the average U.S. vehicle, which is much older than the average Tesla. That distorts the results because all automakers have recently launched new safety features that reduce crashes, the researchers said. So that includes things like, you know, my car's autonomous emergency braking. So even though it's not self-driving, it will try to avoid collisions. That reduces crashes. Tesla's not comparing it to like vehicles. They're comparing it to that. And what I found really interesting here is that they're comparing their crash rate with airbag deployment to the full crash rate in federal data, which I believe is based on crashes involving a tow truck that is called.
Yeah, exactly.
Which can be lower volume. And what I find so damning about that is there is federal data for crashes that involve airbag deployments. You could compare it like for like, and you're choosing not to. And I think that is where we have always been skeptical of how limited the FSD safety data is, and also the fact that they compare it FSD versus a human driver, but it's not FSD versus a human driver because the human is still legally responsible. So it's a human driver plus FSD. And all of these confounding variables, for instance, like, okay, you have FSD, but is the average buyer using it in the most complicated systems they're driving in? So if you're driving in a crowded city in the snow, are you going to lean on FSD? Now, if you're filming videos for YouTube, maybe. But generally speaking, it looks like most of the miles that we can see people are using FSD on is freeway driving, which is the safest form of driving, and then primarily fair weather from what we understand. And so you're very clearly massaging this data and saying things in a very specific way that casts it in a good light. And if I'm going to put my life in someone's hands, the idea that I can't trust the timeline, the methods, or the data, I don't know how you end up winning the battle for people's trust. Maybe it's just that in the end, if the product's cheaper, people aren't going to care. But I love riding in Waymos, and I would put anyone in a Waymo. I would not want to get in a Tesla fully self-driving taxi, because I've seen the way the risk tolerance this company has and the storytelling that always goes around it, and I'm very uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, like, the fact they only have 42 vehicles and that, you know, they're taking these precautions is maybe like a good thing. Like, yeah, they're moving slowly for sure, way slower, way behind Waymo.
Yeah,
and they also appear to have an inferior system based on this report and other stuff we've seen. So, you know, maybe that's something. But four of the sources told Reuters that scaling up safely could take years, which is in stark contrast to what Elon Musk says, right? Which is always next year, always expanding. You mentioned this in last year. He said that it would serve half the U.S. population by the end of 2025. Clearly, that did not happen.
Yeah. I don't think 42 cars is going to serve half the population, but they're close. Maybe with 50.
Maybe if each car held like 1.5 million people.
Instead, they'll hold two.
No, that math is ridiculous.
Yeah, but it's just such a weird problem too, because I think one of the challenges for the consumer facing FSD that I talked about in my story on it, I had two safety related interventions, one of which was like a merging error that it looked like the car wasn't going to be able, like the guy in front of me was not driving the best, but like I ended up taking the wheel because the Tesla was not slowing down and getting out of the way in the way that I would. It's like, it's in this weird valley of complacency on the consumer facing side where I had 150 miles, primarily city, so low average speed, you know, probably 4 hours in the car or something like that. And I had two safety critical interventions because I was approaching it from the lens of, I'm a reviewer, this is new to me. I was locked in. I honestly found it a little more tiring than just driving myself because I was so locked in on supervising it. But you know, when you have an average owner who gets used to only having to intervene once every hour or two, like if I made you watch, you know, a complicated giant movie screen with a bunch of different things moving around and you had to just detect when one was going to collide into something, but that only happened in a 2 second window every hour, what are the odds that you're going to be paying close enough attention to pick that up? And I think it's why I also don't want to only call out Tesla here, because there are other companies that are pursuing this sort of weird, like they're calling it like hands-free point-to-point. I know Mercedes is doing it.
Level 2 plus.
Yeah. And to me, like a Super Cruise level highway assistant, I find useful. And full autonomy, I would certainly find useful. But everything in between that, like Super Cruise eyes off, but very limited domain, and good warning systems, like that is a level of complexity I can handle while still feeling safe. Beyond that, you get into this weird complacent zone where I have to trust the car to handle it most of the time and accept that my attention is going to lapse sometimes, but also know that I'm still legally driving the whole time. And I get why some consumers are willing to drive all their miles on FSD, because I know it works most of the time. I just can't really get my head into that framing ever, because I'm just like, especially when it's a company that I think just, in my opinion, has not taken the safety concerns as seriously as I would hope. I don't get it.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to see. Like, Waymo is by far the leader right now, with over 500 in Austin or in Texas alone, like 10x over 10x more than Tesla. Tesla has definitely like made strides over the years back for like, you know, compared to the time when the FSD beta first came out and the thing was like pretty acting like pretty wild.
Yeah.
So progress and happening.
Check my own skepticism. I will say the last time I used FSD meaningfully, which was probably 6 months ago, 8 months ago, something like that, at fall of last year, it is already way better than I thought they would get to with this technology. So,
yeah,
you know, they've done impossible.
And people, people I've talked to, like self-driving experts and like people in this industry, you know, even like RJ Scaringe, like people are impressed by what Tesla's built. I think the question is, can it get from like, you know, 99% to 99.9 repeating? And that's much, much, much harder.
Yeah.
This message comes from Capital One Commercial Bank. Your business requires commercial banking solutions that prioritize your long-term success. With Capital One, get a full suite of financial products and services tailored to meet your needs today and goals for tomorrow. Learn more at CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Let's move on to plus minus, the segment where we talk about who's up and who's down in the EV world this week. Mac, you're first.
Yeah, so we're starting to get sales reports for May. Not everyone reports sales on a monthly basis, but I'm going to go ahead and give a minus to Ford's EV sales, which are kind of in free fall. Mach-E sales fell 44% year over year, which is not great when that is the only EV they have left. And it's the Mach-E sales trajectory is only a fraction better than the Lightning, which is out of production. Sales for the Lightning fell 45% year over year. So sales of the Mach-E, which still exists,
that's hilarious.
1%. And so it's not a great look when a, you know, your sales are falling roughly as quickly as a model that your manufacturer discontinued like 6 months ago at this point. And I think it shows that Ford is in a really tough spot in terms of EV adoption, because most companies have rolled back their ambitions, but now, you know, Ford has it's only the Mach-E. That car has been on sale for 5 years now. It was not necessarily a class leader in technology or design when it first came out, and I think it's getting stale, and without the tax credit, it's just been tough for them. And so I think they really, really need that first model off the, you know, universal electric vehicle platform, that sub $30,000 electric truck. They need to come on time.
We're all excited for it.
We're excited, but it needs to get here on time. It needs to have a good launch, and it needs to be a great product. It seems like they're committed to it, and I think if it works, it's going to be awesome. But it's tough to see Ford, a company that I think with the Mach-E and the F-150 Lightning felt like among American manufacturers very quick to jump into this in a real way. It's hard to see that like the sales are so brutal for them right now.
Yeah, agreed. I also have a minus. Sad.
Yep. One of those days.
Sad week. My minus is there was this study out this week from a company called Insurify, and it was about EV versus gas insurance rates. It costs 18% more to insure your EV, newer EV, over the course of a year than it does a gas vehicle, which is just like one of those sneaky, unfortunate ways that the kind of cost, the cost benefit, tilts in the favor of gas vehicles.
Is that across models, or is that like the average? Because I know Teslas are specifically really tough to insure, and they're such a huge proportion of the market. I'm curious how much like they're skewing the data set. Because my insurance on my Blazer EV is not, especially for the price of the vehicle, is not considerably. I haven't owned a similar price gas vehicle,
but it wasn't bad. It's definitely skewed. Like, that's one of the things. It's like the headline of this report, and it's totally true, so I don't fault them for it. But some of the headlines that came out from it were, it costs 42% more to insure an EV than it does a gas vehicle. And that is that's what you come to if you compare EVs and gas in their totality.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't account for the fact that most EVs are like 5 years old.
Right.
And gas cars can be 10 or 20 years old. And so they're just like cheap. They're cheap to insure and that kind of thing. So it's not really a good comparison. The 18% is the better one. That's for cars 2024 model year and newer.
Gotcha.
And it's definitely like skewed, because EVs are just more expensive vehicles. Yeah. Like they skew and also luxury. They're newer. Yeah, yeah. All that stuff. So,
well, and I don't mean new because this is comparing 2024. Yeah. No, I mean newer in terms of it's not, I think a lot of people assume it's inherently always going to be way more expensive to replace like a battery than an engine. And it's like, no, it's just that like the supply chain for replacement batteries, the repair shops for that, like all of that takes time to get.
It's, you know, specialized and expensive.
Right. Yeah. And so it's like, well, if every body shop knows how to repair, you know, the HVAC system on your car, but you know, you need an EV certified one to deal with a modern heat pump system with an 8-way valve and all this stuff. There's a lot of ways that's skewing, but it's something that I find disappointing about a lot of, like the original Rivian R1 design, which I love, but just clearly was not designed with repairability as a primary concern. And I think that's something that's just going to keep getting more important because, yeah, it took a while for people to notice the effects of these choices they made, but that's sort of an inherent compromise of this world of mega casting and simplifying production that it can sometimes make it so that you have a bunch of really, a smaller number of really expensive parts that's harder to put together. And to tie these two together, I will say Ford was doing quite a bit of work on the PR side with their, when we went behind the scenes at the factory or at the development center for their EVs, talking about how they're using mega castings, but they're going to be able to replace individual sections of them and sell those individually to reduce repair costs. And I think that's something where the more cheap and mainstream models come out, the more there's going to be pressure to create those, you know, innovative solutions to get us out of this world where a dent on a quarter panel is like a $10,000 repair.
Yeah. It's been getting better. It'll probably continue to. All right. That's the show. Thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all our latest coverage on InsideEVs.com. See you next time.
This message comes from Capital One Commercial Bank. Your business requires commercial banking solutions that prioritize your long-term success. With Capital One, get a full suite of financial products and services tailored to meet your needs today and goals for tomorrow. Learn more at CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.